Good morning. Well, I just started my tape. Good morning. Okay? Tape can't start without it. Okay. Pasuk 26. Pasuk 25. Vayomer HaMelech, the king said, Gizru et hayelad achai l'shnayim, cut the living child in two, utnu et hachatzila achat, et hachatzila echat, give one half and the other half. Vatomer ho'isha asher b'no hachai el hamelech, the woman who the living child indeed belonged to, said to the king, Ki nichmeru rachameha al b'no, because her mercy, her compassion became warmed over about her child. But Tomer, she said, Be Adoni, please, my master, Tnu la et hayolud hachai, give her the living child, v'hameit al tamituhu, and don't put him to death. The Zot omeret, and the other says, and this, of course, is the most stunning and shocking statement of all, Gam li, gam loch, lo yihyeh gezoru. It won't be yours and it won't be mine. Cut the child. How does a woman, I mean, this is, of course, something that also has to be understood. How does a woman make a statement like this? How does a woman make a statement like this? She gets back to kidnapping, But it's such an ugly statement. How do you say it out of your mouth? Not only, she has more. I'll give you a moment. It's much more than. Yeah, what did you? It's much more than her not having a connection. This is inhuman. This is inhuman. This is.
I can assume that she let her jealousy run away with her seichel.
All right, jealousy run away with seichel. No, she's obviously not acting with intelligence. That's for sure. Go ahead.
Okay. According to my notes,
yes.
The Yehuda Chachim said that they were both widows of the same man, the same rich man. And according to Jewish law, the one who has the child, when he dies, he's dead. The father is dead. The one who has the child becomes the apostrophe on his thing. If neither has a child, then they become equal sharers.
Killed. All right, okay.
That's
I hear that.
Now, the other thing, that is very ambitious.
Yeah, I understand. I see you. You're very dangerous. When I give you homework, you all go out and you take me seriously.
Okay, there were several reasons why Shlomo
with
the
secret
was going to the Baal Ham.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, good. Go ahead.
So, right away, there was suspicion on, according to Bob, the accused lost the accuser. Got
it. Yes. In other words,
it started right away because the accuser spoke very polite. I didn't even think of it that way, but spoke very politely in a manly way, in a logical way. And the accused immediately started to yelling, and that right away put her in a bad position. And she was perfectly willing for the baby to die. It was, and Shlomo figured in advance that the one whose baby it wasn't would not worry about the baby.
All right. Okay. Go ahead.
I'm not such a genius, but I said it last week.
Yes.
That so I just read the little interpretation.
Yes.
Here, and that was that the one whose child had died said, thought to herself, well, if I can't have my child, she's not going to have hers.
But well,
she
said,
to do it. But
that's
she
said.
An extension of what.
Yeah, thank you.
What I said without even having read this particular interpretation followed exactly.
Except, of course, number one, it is such an... You can think something, but to say it, and to say it the way she says it, she knows, doesn't she realize that she's going to lose the case over here? Doesn't she realize that? How do you say, kill the child? The child is innocent. I mean, listen, kill the child. I don't have such a great answer. maybe the answer is in the world of the, the spirit, so to speak. And this is in a completely different essay by Rav Chaim Shmulevitz. He says that there was something else that Shlomo HaMelech understood. Shlomo HaMelech understood that when a person is in the process of committing a terrible crime, there's only one way for the person to go, and that's down. In other words, one can do an aveira, and after the aveira is over, one can stop, reflect, express remorse, regret. All of that is possible after the aveira is finished, complete. So you did something. You did a terrible thing. But while one is in the process of doing an aveira, there's a completely different mode of thought or feeling. There is evil that inhabits the person. And as long as evil inhabits the person, one is going to continually fall. And the fall will be that far that a woman is able to say, Gam li gam loch lo yieh gezodu. In other words, there are two, the same person can be two people. One while in the process of doing an aveira, one afterwards. Afterwards, there are those who will say chatasi, there are those who will express remorse and guilt and regret and shame and embarrassment. But that can all begin only the moment the aveira is over. While the aveira is being done, a man is capable, or a woman is capable, of doing things even worse. Because an aveira represents a fall. A human being, an intelligent, sensitive human being who is really human, is on a certain plane, a certain emotional, a certain spiritual plane, a certain ethical plane. When one is in the process of doing a terrible aveira, one drops. And when one drops, there's only one way to go, and that's further down. And the proof that he brings is also from something in Malachim that we also discussed in a different connection. And that was the story of Yechiel of Beit El. Yechiel of Beit El is the one who rebuilds the city of Yericho. Right, but there was a curse. Yehoshua placed a curse on anybody who's going to build the city of Yericho, that with his firstborn son he will lay the foundations, and with his youngest son, the death of his youngest son, he is going to put on the gates to the city. Why doesn't the man stop in the middle? He keeps burying child after child. Why doesn't he stop? You know why he doesn't stop? Because he's in the process, he's continuing the construction of the city. As long as he's continuing the construction of the city, he is in the midst of doing the aveira. And when a person is in the middle of doing an aveira, imagine that he's on a roller coaster going down. And there's no other way to go but down. The only possibility for man to begin to rise is first what must come is a cessation of all activity. Stop the aveira. If this woman would have just stopped for a moment, what was she in the process of doing? Yes, she is in the process of kidnapping a baby. She's in the process of kidnapping a baby. And as long as she is in the process of kidnapping a baby, and she hasn't stopped, she's still involved in it, then the only place for man to go is down. Down, down, down. All the way. And that's exactly what happens to her. There's no other way to explain the ugliness of what she says. Gam li gam loch lo yiyeh gezoru. It won't be mine, nor yours, gezoru. Now, interestingly enough, and I haven't paid much attention to this, maybe I'll ask you to pay attention to it. What would we have expected of her to say? Gam loch, gam li, lo yiyeh, right? It's not going to be yours, and it's not going to be mine. Right? I know that I'm treading on dangerous ground now because I'm not certain where I'm going to go. That can happen to all of us. Why does she say first, Gam li, Gam loch, lo yiyeh, gezono? In other words, because she sees, what she's saying is, she already sees she's lost the child. It's not going to be mine, and therefore it's not going to be yours either. Okay, good, good. Huh? It's a confession. The gam, or the gam li, is she is confessing, yeah, it's not mine. It's not mine, and it's not going to be yours, not going to be yours either. Gazelle. Yes?
That one of the comments that was made, that these women were, why saying that? Where does that come?
It's a medrash.
Yeah.
Medrash. And medrash, of course, is something that... remember, there are a number of things over here. They're both in the same house. What are they doing?
They're harlots.
Yes. So, of course, they're always... the Targum Yonatan Ben Uziel says they were not harlots, they were innkeepers. So that's the medrash. Medrash very often is the cement in between the bricks of the story of Tanakh. There are moments at which the medrash will inject something that we may not otherwise have known. But that doesn't mean that we have to learn the pasuk that way. Let me take you into, I don't even know where I want to go yet, but let's say the following. I want to get to a point where we're going to look at this from, let's do it now, and then we'll say the rest later. Isn't there a halachic angle over here? What would the halacha say? I'm giving you 10 seconds. What would the halacha say? Imagine that this question is being brought before us right here in class. What would the halacha say? We're going to learn a little Gemara with you. The two women come before the two... Wait a minute. Shnayim ochazin betalit. Who says both are holding the baby? Only one is holding the baby. And the woman who stands up before Shlomo is saying, that baby that woman has is my baby. What's the halacha? I can't hear you. Possession is 9/10 of the law. Please talk like a London. Huh? Ham chazaka, which means the person who's holding it, as far as the halach is concerned, possession is not 9/10 of the law, it's 10/10 of the law. And what's the halach when somebody holds something and I want it from that somebody? Hamotzi mechavero olav haraya. I want you to learn these four words. We're going to turn you into Talmidei Chachamim. Hamotzi mechavero, the one who wants to take something away from his friend, Olav Haraya, upon him is the responsibility to bring proof. I want something from you. I say you owe me $100. So the Bezdin is going to say, Bevakasha, please bring proof. What's going on over here? I want to look at it from a cold, halachic point of view. Not, I shouldn't have said that. I take it back. Halach is never cold. Okay, take it back. You see, we can make a mistake. Huh? Straightforward.
No.
Let's see. There are different approaches to that. There are different approaches. We'll see right away. It's not simple who's who. But listen, I'm asking you the following question. We're going to talk about woman A and woman B. As the story is over here, woman A and B come before Shlomo. Woman B is holding the child. Woman A is the one who says, that child is my child. So the question that I'm asking, and it's asked by one of the Mefarshim, the halacha should simply have been, Bevakasha, your claim that that baby is yours, bring me proof that it's yours. Hamotzi mechavedo olav haraya. And the fact is, there's a Gemara that says the following. Oh, I'm going to tell you everything. A Gemara in Bechorot that says the following. A Gemara in Bechorot, second parak. Chab shehifkid kle chai eitzel bal habayit. V'yesh le bal habayit kle echad. Umeit echad mehen. Listen, I'll tell you more. A man gives to somebody a goat to watch. And the man to whom I give the goat to watch has a goat of his own. Umeit echad mehen. And one of the two goats died. Havi hamafkid, I, who gave it to you for safekeeping, I am now the one who wants to take the remaining goat from you. So my responsibility is to prove that the goat that died was your goat, and my goat is the living goat. So obviously, that's exactly what should happen over here. Says there's a mafarish that's printed together with the Abarbanel, who says the following. By the way, that's an interesting question. A question that's been dealt with in halacha for a long time now. And not only with DNA, the question of blood types and blood samples. There are all sorts of ways in proving paternity. And a great deal is written about it. But if I'm going to go into that, we'll never learn about Shlomo. Mishpat Shlomo. There's a Tosfos. One of the Mefarshim says the following. Why is it that when I give you a goat to take care of for me, and you have a goat of your own, and one of them dies, I have to prove that the one that died was yours, and the living goat is mine? That's only, the halacha is only true if it was known that you had a goat of your own. You got that? If it's known for a fact that you have a goat of your own, and now I give you a goat that you should watch it for me, and one of them dies, then the halacha is, I have to prove that the living goat is mine. What happens if we don't know? If we don't know whether you had a goat or you didn't have a goat? Then you know what it means? Where we have an equal, it could belong to one or it could belong to the other. We have no way of proving it. Maybe what you would have to do then is what Sarah said. Both of them have a claim to the goat, so you divide the goat in half. Goats, by the way, you can easily divide in half. Okay. Now, let's take a closer look at the Pesukim. Because I'm going to show you something in the Pesukim that's very fascinating. Let's read the woman. Let's go back to Pesuk 17. Chapter 3, Pesuk 17. Vatomer ha'isha ha'achat. One woman said, Bi Adoni, please, my master. Ani v'ha'isha hazot, I and this woman, Yoshvot b'bayit echad. We were living in one house. V'eleiv imod abayit, and I gave birth with her in the house. V'yihi b'yom ha'shlishi, and it came to pass on the third day, lulidity, after I had given birth. V'teled gam ha'isha hazot, also this woman gave birth. V'anachnu yagdav, we are together. Enzar itanu babayit. There is no stranger with us in the house. Zulati shtayim anachnu babayit. Only the two of us are in the house. Now, why doesn't she begin her claim by saying there's no one in the house? What she really should have said is the following. My dear king, we are alone in the house. There is no stranger with us in the house. Only the two of us are in the house. She says it in three ways.
Do you hear? Anachnu yachdav, we are alone together. Ein zor, there is no stranger with us in the house. Zul, and if the king doesn't understand yet, he says, Zulati shtayim anachnu babayit, aside from us, there are only us two in the house. Why doesn't she begin with that? Because the whole problem is the result of the fact that there's nobody who can testify. Would there be somebody who could stand up in the court and testify? There would be no problem. There are no witnesses. So what's really, the whole case is based on one thing. There are no witnesses. You know what's happening over here? The woman who's standing up to claim the child from the other woman who's holding the child, only one is holding the child. Woman A doesn't have the child. She's claiming that the child held in woman B's hands is hers. So she says the following. The woman said, I and this woman, we were in one house, and I gave birth with her in the house. By the way, when the first woman, woman A, when she gave birth, there were people in the house. There were people in the house. There were people in the house. Wait a minute. I'll tell you exactly how I know that there were people in the house. Because this woman is being very careful about everything that she says. In the second passage, she says that it came to pass on the third day, Lilidity, on the third day when I gave birth, when she gave birth, there was no one in the house. Do you know what that means? That I had a child, the whole world knows. That she had a child, do you know how you know? Only because I'm testifying that she had a child. If I would not tell you that she gave birth, there isn't a soul out there in the world that could tell you that she gave birth. By the way, there is no habeas corpus here. No habeas corpus. I don't even know when this case was brought before Shlomo. But we always have to read what the Psukim are telling us. And if she says after the birth of the second woman, and she says, yes, the other woman gave birth, we don't even need, how do we know that the first woman had a child? We know that because everybody knows. There were people in the house. The only time there was no one in the house was on the third day. Which means now, how do we know that this woman holding the baby indeed gave birth to a baby? Only for one reason. Because I say so. Because I say so. Nobody else. Now, let me just finish the... that I'm going to. Which means the following. If we're going to take the case of our goats before, Satosha said, when do we say when do we say that the goat belongs to when do we say that the goat is divided? When do we divide the goat? No. When do we say Hamotzi Mechaveiro all of Araya? When do we say that the person who claims has to bring proof that that the live goat is his? Only if we already knew that the owner had a goat of his own. If we know that he has a goat of his own, and now I gave him a goat to watch, and one of them dies, so that means the fellow to whom I gave my goat to watch, everybody knows that he had a goat. Therefore, if I want the one remaining goat, I have to prove that it was his that died and mine that's alive. What happens if we didn't know whether you had a goat?
Then they both have to prove.
Then they're divided, because then, on the one hand, we never knew that one person had a goat. We did know that the other had a goat. What happens is the two sides are equal. The one to whom I gave the goat to watch, he has the living goat in hand. He is the Murzik. He is the one who has possession of it, which is, in this case, you know what possession in this case is? Possession in this case is 5/10 of the law. because the only way we know that he had a goat is because I say that he had a goat. So that means he has only 5 pence. I, on the other hand, am the one who everybody knows that I gave him a goat to watch, and he doesn't deny it. So what do we have over here? Yes, we have woman B who's holding on to a baby. So she has possession. Is that possession 10 tenths of the law? No. You know why? Because it's common knowledge in the world that woman A gave birth and she has a baby. That woman B, who's holding the child, has a baby. There is no proof in the world. Nobody. There wasn't a soul who can testify that she gave birth. Except this woman. Which means, since you're the knowledge that the world has that this woman gave birth comes only from me. So there's another general rule in halacha. Hapesha oser, hu hapesha hikir. The same mouth that tells you that this woman gave birth is also the same mouth that is telling you that her baby died. Which means we are now 50-50. From even a halachic point of view, if it wouldn't be a baby, you know what we would have to do with it? We would have to divide it in half. So therefore, even from the halachic point of view, and I don't mean to say that Shlomo was going to kill the baby al pi halacha. No. God told me to kill the baby. It's not at all what he had in mind. He meant, he was of course going to use this in order to bring the truth out. But why? What we're really explaining is, why doesn't he tell woman A, prove it? In other words, the question is, how can Shlomo HaMelech act against halacha? All that he should have said when the two women came before him was, I hear what you're saying, I understand your pain, but I'm sorry, prove it. That woman is holding on to the baby. That woman is in possession of the baby. I can't do anything for you. So we have to find some way, and it's right there in the words, something that tells us that there's a balance over there between the two. It's not a simple shaila. And for another reason, it cannot be a simple shaila. Do you think these two women came first to Shlomo HaMelech? You know what kind of a shaila was brought to Shlomo HaMelech? A question that others could not answer? That kind of a question was brought to Shlomo. If it would be an open and shut case, if they would come before us, what would we say? Prove it. Sir. Except, of course, for that reason, I'm ready to say they were Nashim Zonot, and therefore she was concealing her pregnancy. They were alone in a house because they were concealing pregnancy.
A young girl.
Oh, gosh, you can't conceal. Sarah, proof is simply the following. Bring somebody here. Why didn't Shlomo simply act halachically? Bring somebody here. Prove it to me. Prove to me at least that you were pregnant. Prove something. Ah, but it doesn't mean that they saw her. It's not that we're supposing many things. We have to suppose them. Do you know why we have to suppose them? Otherwise, it would be an open and shut case. It would be so simple that any first-year student in Talmud would have been able to pass in this shaila. It has to be a complicated one. Because if it's not a complicated one, so then what are we showing the great wisdom of Shlomo HaMelech? Great wisdom! Fancy, tricky bulls over here.
The fact that the woman said she had faith, she made the claim, but I think it shows she didn't even have to say it.
Oh no, she did have to say it! Oh, wait a minute. I take that back. No, she's right. Woman A didn't even have to tell us that woman B had given birth. By the way, That's the strength of her claim. The strength of her claim rests on the fact that she said that woman did indeed give birth, but her child died. Which means that woman A is being very honest. And it is her honesty that now equals out the possession of the other woman. That's the halachic point. In other words, Shlomo HaMelech, we're not talking about Shlomo HaMelech passing the Shaila that any Rav and Harnof could pass the Shaila to a big deal. I mean, they need Shlomo HaMelech. Other Rabbanim and Harnof. Yeah, oh. You have another Rav. Yeah, okay. All right. Which really brings us to a much larger question. And the larger question is going to take us on a little bit, not a little bit, a shtickl journey through Tanakh. But it may be a very worthwhile journey. The journey through Tanakh is in order to find, number one, what indeed is the function of Melech as Shofet? Is a king a king or is a king a judge? What is his function? And in the event that we are going to be able to see that there is some kind of a function of judge to the king, is the king's function as judge similar to all other judges? Or is there some very special license that the king has to deal with problems in a way that a normal court of law would not be able to deal with it? Is there greater leeway that the halacha gives to Melech than to anyone else? By the way, if I just ask you off the top of your kepalach over there, how many other cases in Tanakh do you know of a case that is brought before a king that the king should pass judgment? Huh? What? What about David? No, that's what she wanted to say just now. Sorry.
Something else
with David. All right. Something else with David. You saw the body language. That's right. You saw the smile. You were watching me. Let me ask you. Huh? No. I'm talking about a Shiloh that's brought, plain talk, a Shiloh that's brought before a king. Huh? No. Okay. All right. Okay. I knew that you wouldn't. I knew. I'll give you the answer. When Natan Hanavi comes to David and he tells him a story about a rich man and a poor man, right? A rich man who has a lot of shetzalach, and then there's a poor man who has only one little shetzalach, right? And along comes a guest, and the rich man goes and he takes the.
Yes. But that's called a hypothetical.
Wait a minute. We're going to learn something from the hypothetical. By the way, there are a number of hypothetical questions that are brought before kings. We would say staged questions that are brought before kings in order to elicit a response. You're going to have a little chazada. We're going to do a little review of Shmuel Bet. Very good. Yoav sends the Isha HaTekoit, the woman from Tekoa, before David HaMelech, and this woman comes in and says, I had two sons. One son killed the other son. Now the rest of the family wants to kill the one son that I have remaining. All right? That was, we're going to go over them all. That was another hypothetical question. All right. Let's go back to question number one. David is asked by Nathan after the sin of Bathsheba and Uriah Hachifi. He's asked about the man Kivsat Harash, the Shepsala of the poor man. So what does David HaMelech task him? What is he tasking? Ben Mavet Ha'ish Hazer. The man is a man of death. Now, all that the man did was steal a Shepsala and slaughter it. What's the halacha in Torah if somebody steals a Shepsala and slaughters it and shechts it? So he has to pay four times for four Shepsala for a Shepsala, and five cows for a cow. Well, how does David HaMelech say Ben Mavet HaIsh HaZeh, this man is a man of death? So there are two pshatim. One is Rashi. Rashi says that David was passing moral judgment. He didn't mean that this man, who David assumes that there is such a man. He doesn't know yet that man is going to be himself. But David is passing moral and ethical judgment. As Rashi on the spot says, you steal from a poor man, you're stealing his soul, you're stealing his life. So this is the kind of crime for which there should be a death penalty, but he certainly doesn't mean a death penalty. That's Rashi's approach. I mean, obviously, according to Rashi's approach, there was certainly verbal violence involved in what it was that was said by David. Ben Mavet HaIsh HaZeh. The Malbim takes another approach. The Malbim's approach is, and this is a halacha in the Rambam, and the halacha in the Rambam is the basis of it all. There were two levels of judgment by Klal Yisrael. There were shoftim v'shotrim titein lecha b'chol sharecha, in all of your gates there were judges and there were officers. The shoftim were the ones who passed judgment. The shotrim were the ones who carried out judgment. The shofet has to deal within the confines of halacha. The shofet does not have the right to move outside the framework of halacha. The framework of halacha, by the way, I don't want to leave the impression that it's absolutely rigid and everything is encompassed within a simple mizgeret, a simple framework. The framework of halacha is a liberal one, and there's a great deal of place for maneuver. But a melech has license. A melech has license to pass judgment beyond the halacha. The Rambam says it. The Rambam says it in Chot Rotzeach. All right, no comment. The Rambam says the following: V'chol eila haratzchanim, all of these murderers, v'chayotze behem, and similar ones, she'inan mechuyavim mitab bedin, killers or criminals who cannot be put to death by bedin, they simply don't. Either there isn't sufficient proof, there's circumstantial evidence which is not accepted before a bedin. There may even have been witnesses, but if the person wasn't warned in advance, he can't be put to death. There are all sorts of limitations on Bedin carrying out the death sentence. But all of those people whom Bedin cannot punish with a death sentence, Imrotza Melech Yisrael, if the king of Israel wants Lahargam Bedin HaMalchut, to put them to death by royal edict, V'takanat HaOlam, in order to correct and fix the world, Adar should be Ado. He has the right to do it. It means that there is license given to the king to act beyond and outside the framework of halacha. If a king sees that a situation is out of control, in other words, there are checks and balances. What it really means is when there was malchut by Klal Yisrael, there was the formal system of law, which was the Bet Din, the Sanhedrin. There were two other means of bringing down a sinner. if we could not do it in the, you know, a jury of 12, acquit somebody. You know, they can even acquit somebody who we may see is clearly guilty. They may acquit him. So what does it mean? So there are really two levels beyond the Bet Din. One is the Melech, the king of this world, and then there's Malko Shel Olam, the Rebbeinu Shel Olam, king of the world. Elokim Nitzav Ba'adat Kel. Pasuk in Tehillim. God is the one who stands in the congregation of justice. If for some reason a person cannot be put to death or punished by man's law, there's always a check and balance. There's a Rebbeinu Shel Olam up there who's going to take care of it. But when there was a kingdom, the king had the right, if he saw fit, to go ahead and put somebody to death, even when Bet Din could not. When he sees that this is necessary, when crime becomes rampant, when it seems that the, you know, mid-course corrections are necessary for Klal Yisrael. Which means the following. The Malbim therefore says, when David HaMelech exclaims to Natan HaNavi, Ben Mavet HaYish HaZeh, this man is a man of death, what he was first of all taking into consideration were all the circumstances, and that the king has a right to do. The evil involved, the rishus, the terrible example that's being set, the ugliness of what this person has done, the king has a right to say, Ben Mavet HaYish HaZeh, this man is a man of death. So while Rashi says that David HaMelech is making a moral and an ethical judgment, the Malbim says, and this is clearly on the basis of the Rambam, he is making a real, real judgment. Ben Mavet HaYish HaZeh. Then, of course, in that case, what Natan HaNavi was really doing was the best way to convince somebody of something is if the somebody is convinced by himself. What he really did over here was he was able to bring David HaMelech to a point where David HaMelech himself passes judgment. Man, rich man, poor man, rich man takes all that poor man has. King takes wife of Uriah Hittite. All right, but we spent enough weeks talking about that last year. So all I will say for those who are not here when we talk about David HaMelech, Kol HaOmed David Chata, anybody who says that David truly sinned in a legal way, Einu Ela Tova, making a terrible mistake, because we know, Halacha tells us, that whoever went out to wage war for David HaMelech, get Kritut HaYakot Heiv Lishto, gave his wife a get before he went out to war, so that Bathsheba certainly was not a married woman. David HaMelech did not commit adultery. We're not whitewashing, but he did not commit adultery. Yes? Of course there was a Sanhedrin. And you know who the head of the Sanhedrin was? David HaMelech. It was David Ubeit Dino. David Ubeit Dino. So why does Natan come with this staged question? You know why? Precisely because David would be found innocent before the Sanhedrin. Excellent that you asked the question, so you gave me the opportunity to give the answer. It's because it was clear to everybody that what David HaMelech did was legally, technically, in all other ways, he was absolutely functioning within the law. You'd come to Sanhedrin would have thrown the case out. They wouldn't even have remanded him for 4 days. They would have thrown the case out. So therefore, Natan HaNavi has to deal with the case on a moral and an ethical plane. Shame it wasn't. And that's what he wants. He wants to elicit that response from David. And he does it in a brilliant way. What Natan HaNavi is really doing is he's educating David. And the best way to educate somebody is when you can elicit that response to come from the person himself. You ask him a question and he responds, and then all of a sudden you tell him, ah.
But it was an objective.
Huh? He did present in an objective way.
And David HaMelech's response is objective for a king. For the license that's given to a king to deal with questions of halacha beyond or outside the framework, the formal framework of halacha. You've asked another question.
The Tebi Kulam.
Let's get this to the... Why doesn't David HaMelech catch on until Natan HaNaviv tells him, Ata HaIsh, you are the man? Do you know why? Because he thinks he's innocent. He does not yet see himself as being guilty until Natan HaNaviv tells him, Ata HaIsh, you are the man. Which means that both formally before a Sanhedrin, Natan knows, this ain't gonna wash. There'll never be an indictment of David, not on these charges. And David himself was functioning within halacha, but it's not shame. Therefore, Natan HaNaviv has to bring him to realize, aha, compare it with this story. The second one, very good. Ein Adam Meisim Atzmo Rasha. No, that's not most probably what you were thinking of. Ein Adam Roe Nig'e Atzmo. That's a halachic term that's used sort of as a metaphor. A halacha is that if a person has some kind of a blemish on his skin, he has to come to the Kohen. Now, a Kohen can see somebody else's Neg Atzadat and Taskan on it, but a Kohen cannot look at his own Nega. So that's the halacha. But of course, what it means is that we cannot see our own guilt. But I don't like that too much right now. Because that would mean, of course, that the only one to can see my guilt is somebody else, right? And that's exactly what's going on over here. Everybody sees everybody else's guilt, but they don't see their own guilt. All right. Look. Let's go further. Yes.
The therapeutic process is a good therapist. Always...
The classic example of the great therapist is Natan HaNaviv. There's no doubt about it. What he sets up for David HaMelech is so powerful, and he succeeds. You see how well he succeeds. He elicits the great response from David. A strong, strong, emotional, and a powerful response. And then he turns around and he says, Atah, you are the man. And which means he has brought David to a self-recognition, which is as the therapist over there says, is the best way for a therapist. We're always lecturing to people and giving musa, but that's not the best way. The best way to go about it is to speak about something different and let people understand. Except, of course, the problem is, how do people understand? What's the classic story that every rabbi has? You want to give musa to one guy in shul, and you say a drasha that's addressed to him, and then when you come out of shul, the fellow comes over and says, Rabbi, did you give them the words? It's happened to every one of us. It's happened to every one of us. That's right. In the parasha of Melech, I have so much to say. So let me say something else before I take you on a further journey into Tanakh. I had pointed out that the Haftorah, this perek, now interestingly enough, it's more than interesting. This parak, beginning from Pasuk 15, is the Haftorah for Parashat Niketz. Now, if we're not going to have class that week because it's the week of Hanukkah, we're always off the week of Hanukkah. You all need a rest. And most probably you're going to have so many events going on in Hanukkah, you won't have any energy for class. The Haftorah begins with Pasuk 15. Vayikav Shlomo. Shlomo woke up, v'hinei chalom. And behold, it's a dream. Vayavo Yerushalayim, vayamod lefnei Aron Brit Hashem. He came to Yerushalayim and he stood before the Ark of God. Vayal Olot, Vayas Shlomim, Vayas Mishta L'chol HaKodesh. He made a great party for all of the servants. This is the Haftorah. There begins the Haftorah for Parashat Mikates. So now I've looked through some of the Mepharshim. You know, I'm always one of those that is looking for the relationship between the Haftorah and the Sedra. And I am mystified. I am mystified. All of the Mepharshim deal with the relationship between the Sedra and the Haftorah as being really no more than this first pasuk. Because what do we have in Parashat Mikates? Paro has a dream. Not only Paro has a dream, Paro dreams twice, right? So all of the Mepharshim deal, here's a dream, and there's a dream, okay? Now, there in Parashat Mikates, so of course there are, I wouldn't say similarity, well, the only similarities between the two dreams are, in Parashat Mikates, it's a king who has a dream, and in the Haftorah, it's a king who has a dream. I would say that that's where the similarity ends. The king's dream in Parashat Mikates is about the economy, you know, an economy that's gonna go to pot. There's gonna be a great economy in the new Middle East for 7 years, and after that, the new economy, there's gonna be a pashlugana economy after that. No economy ever stays good for forever. Of course, there are other differences between the two dreams. Paro gets up in the morning, take a look at the difference between the two. Paro gets up in the morning, he's upset, he's disturbed, his heart is racing and beating, his blood pressure is up, he's an extremely disturbed person. Shlomo gets up, he knows the dream, he knows the meaning of the dream, he's overjoyed, and he expresses his joy by coming to Yerushalayim, bringing sacrifices, and he makes Mishta L'chol Avodah. He makes a party for all of his servants. Right. So, okay, here a dream, there a dream. I'm just looking into one of the Mepharshim that deals with the so of course there are similarities also in language. And by the way, this of course we should never lose sight of the fact that at the end of Parashat Vayeshev, immediately before Mikates, there are also dreams. I mean, dreams. Beginning with Parashat Vayetzeh, dreams are so integral nearly to all of the parashiyot. And I don't believe, how do you like that? I don't believe that the dreams or the dream is the reason why this Haftorah is chosen, why this Perek is chosen as a Haftorah. You know why? Because if the dream would be the reason why it's chosen, do you know where the Haftorah should have begun? At the beginning of the chapter that tells us the dream? We're not told of the dream. Do you know what I believe the relationship between the Haftorah, this Perek, and the Sedra is? What the dream leads to. In the Haftorah, the dream leads immediately to a demonstration to all of Israel of the great wisdom of Shlomo. And in the Sedra, the dreams of Pharaoh bring to a demonstration of Joseph's wisdom. It's not the dream. The dream is secondary. Would the dream be the reason for the choice of the Haftorah? I say it again. Then the Haftorah should have begun at the beginning of chapter 3. Tell us the whole dream. God appears to Shlomo in Givon, and he asks him, "What is it that I can give you? Anything that you ask for, I will give you." Shlomo says, "I want a lev, shomea, a heart that hears, so I should be able to judge my people." And God tells him, "I'll give you everything, because who has that?" If the dream is important, then that should have been Haftorah. But you know what our rabbis did? They intentionally left out the dream. Because they really want that the focus of the Haftorah should be the wisdom of Shlomo. What do they say about Yosef and the Sedra? After you have told us this, Ein Chacham Kamocha, there is no one as wise as you in all of Egypt, and therefore you are the one who's going to rule. Isn't there also the possibility
that we see before our very eyes in Sedra and Haftarah, who were the two possible contenders? Who were the two that could have been kings of Israel? Yosef is the one who saw himself as king, and Yehuda saw himself as king. In a sense, Yosef, who rises to great wisdom, and not only wisdom in the Sedra, he also becomes a melech. He's a melech. If there's anybody who has a resume on which he can say that he served as vice melech to the greatest king of the era, it's Yosef. But despite that, the choice is going to be Yehuda, which is of course something that we discussed in a different context. But I just feel that I'm going to keep looking at more than a portion. I just feel that they sort of missed the real intent of the Haftarah and the choice of the Haftarah, really to place before us what really is the purpose of the whole Sedra. The purpose of the whole Sedra is to remove Yosef from prison and bring him before Paro as the great one who's going to interpret the dream of Paro. Yes, but I say, remember, this is a Haftarah that's very rarely read because it's nearly always Shabbos Hanukkah. The fact that, I forgot, I have to check how many times in the last century we've read this Haftarah. I think more often, there are about 10 times during the century where both Vayeshev and Miketz are Shabbos Hanukkah. We have two Shabbos Hanukkahs where Hanukkah is sort of enveloped by a Shabbos on one side and a Shabbos on the other, so there are two Haftarahs for Shabbos Hanukkah, a Vayeshev and a Miketz one, and then of course there are the rare times, and I have to check the calendar, I didn't do that. Yes, I'm sorry.
That was exactly what I was going to say. If it's such an important Haftarah, it's so rarely,
nearly almost always, but I'll check it out.
Now
every parak in Tanakh is important. So what are we going to do about all those prakim in Tanakh that didn't become Haftarahs? Only about 70 became Haftarahs.
So what I'm saying, why would Rosh Hashanah over this? So
because Roni Vesimchi is Chanukah, and Chanukah takes precedence simply because we take out at least two Sifrei Torah. I think, wait a minute, this year Shabbos Chanukah, there are three Sifrei Torah. So the Maftar, the Haftarah is always related to the Maftar. And since the last Sefer Torah is Chanukah, so the Haftarah has to be related to Chanukah. The only time when you read this Haftarah is when the Shabbos is a Shabbos Miketz. So this is a Haftarah for Miketz. Do you got that?
No.
I know. But after we finish reading Parashas Miketz, we read from the second Sefer Torah, and a third. And the Haftarah, by Halacha, is always related to the last Sefer you read in. And since the last Sefer you read, we read, all of Klal Yisrael reads, is about Chanukah, so the Haftarah is related, therefore, to Chanukah, and not to Miketz. It's only when it's not a Shabbos Chanukah, so the only act in town is Parshas Miketz, then this is the Haftarah for Parshas Miketz. All right, I think we cut the shear in half. I only got half of it said today. But the whole idea of Melech as Shofet, what emerges here, needs a little bit more elaboration. I'm sure there must be a halacha in the Rambam that opposes that. The king is bound by Jewish law just like anybody else. That's a Mishnah in Sanhedrin, yes. The king is bound by law.